Hello, this is Claire Curtis, and you're listening to The Letterbox Show. Today, I'm here to talk about my four favorite movies, Twilight, New Moon, Eve's Bayou, Howl's Moving Castle, and Honeymoon.
Greetings, Twihards and Bayou babes. You're listening to The Letterbox Show, where we bring on people we love to talk about the movies that mean the most to them. I'm Mitchell Beaupre, joined by my co-host, Greta Gerwig's new best friend, Mia Levachino. And today is a very exciting episode. I think if you've ever listened to this podcast or read a story in our editorial magazine Journal, you've surely heard the name of today's guest. We reference them often as they are regularly delivering some of the best, most creative lists on Letterboxd and writing monumentally excellent reviews. I mean, honestly, I'm going to say it here. This is the first time I've ever said anything like this. Our guest today, my favorite person to follow on Letterboxd. Period. End of story. That's it.
I'm going to throw up.
Wow.
That's the way to start the episode.
It's just how we bond here. It's fine.
We all throw up and then the episode starts.
High praise from Letterboxd senior editor. Look at that. Yes, our guest today... Clara Curtis, along with being an incredible follow on Letterboxd, Clara is also the co-host of the House of Cinema podcast, where they dive into everything from the latest releases to massive A24 marathons to retrospectives on The Devil Wears Prada and so much more. Clara, where the hell have you been, Loca?
Oh my God. I'm so glad we got that line out of the way because like it's the definitive line. Yeah, this is very exciting for me. I genuinely like screamed when I got the invite. I was like, oh, this can't be real. And it's so exciting. So I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to, if I'm correct, be the first person to pick a Twilight movie for this podcast. Am I? I think I am.
I think so. We can have the fact checkers. We'll make sure that this is all correct before this might get edited out. But I believe that this is the first, you know, example of Twilight happening. That's why
I had to be on. I muscled my way in.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I had to be here for Letterboxd show history.
Yes.
Claire, to kind of kick us off, before we get into New Moon, which I think is going to take off, you know, the majority of the episode. This is basically going to be a New Moon podcast. But I wanted to start by talking a little bit, because I love your list on Letterboxd so much. And I wanted to talk a little bit about them because like, they're not only incredible, but they're also like incredibly popular. Your Good for Her Cinematic Universe list has like 20,000 likes. Your Movies Where There Are No Men list has like not too far behind. And you've also got these really creative, beautifully titled lists. Like This Is My Meal, I Call This Girl Dinner, all about films where women feast.
You have my favorite list.
Which one is it?
The Robert Pattinson Masturbating Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
We can guess what that one's about.
Yeah. It's a little list, but it has a good impact.
I have seen all 28 of his feature films, and he does this often.
Yeah.
So thank you for...
There's more than you would expect. Yes. More than most actors, I think, have a list like this. And my personal favorite of your list is male protagonists that I can easily beat up in a fight.
Yeah.
I think is so good and so accurate. The men on there,
they're going down.
They're going down easy in a Clara Curtis battle. But I wanted to ask you, you know, so we've heard Mia's favorite list of yours, my favorite list of yours. Do you have a favorite list of your own that you've made? Like one that you hold especially close to your heart?
Oh, wow. What a question. I feel like Good for Her is like very special because that was like kind of the first, honestly, that's like one of the first lists I ever made on Letterboxd. And so then it was especially like jarring when everyone started liking it. I was like, who are all these people? and I think I like that one a lot too because it's introduced me to so many new films because people are so eager to be like, this movie qualifies. And I get such a diverse watch list out of it. So I really value it for that. I think the other one I especially love is I have a list called My Dad Would Have Loved That. And it's just like a collection of movies that my dad would have loved if he was around to see them. And I like that one because it's just like very reflective and kind of meditative for me. Yeah. Also, I'm glad you shouted out Girl Dinner. Girl Dinner's new. Girl Dinner's like a fresh baby.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I was looking through them the other day and I was like, I don't think I've seen this one before. And it is very
I'm
rad.
I'm big on Girl Dinner TikTok right now. So I'm having fun with that.
Well, let's move on right into Twilight Saga New Moon. We're all heard of this one, huh? Heard of it? Directed by Chris White instead of my girl, Katherine Hardwick. That's okay. 2.5 average. Let's bump those numbers up a little bit, right? I guess Mitchell and I gave it a 2.5, but
I think by the end of this, we're giving it four spies.
I think by the end of this, we're both going to go into our little diaries and update. We're going to give it 5 stars, of course. But 1,900 members have it in their 4 faves. That's very powerful. So this is for you, all 1,900 members.
Yes.
I'll say the synopsis, even though we all know what it's about, but for the uninformed, let's let them know. Forks, Washington resident Bella Swan is reeling from the departure of her vampire love, Edward Cullen, and finds comfort in her friendship with Jacob Black, a werewolf? But before she knows it, she's thrust into a centuries-old conflict, and her desire to be with Edward at any cost leads her to take greater and greater risks.
Oh, what a synopsis.
This New Moon, it's on the official Letterboxd list, the 100 most obsessively rewatched love stories, which are narrative feature films where the romantic relationship is central to the plot and have been logged 5 or more times by the most Letterboxd members. New Moon, number 15 on that list of the 100 most obsessively rewatched love stories. Twilight, the OG Twilight's number 4. So people are hitting that more often, but New Moon not too far behind. And Clara, you, in your Letterboxd stats, you've logged New Moon 10 times, which is tied for the most logged of anything that you've seen with, of course, Twilight. So why don't you kick us off by why New Moon is such a repeat viewing for you? Why you keep going back to it?
Well, I think I like New Moon especially because it's got like the silly charm of Twilight where there's lines that are just like so goofy still and you kind of just like, what did they just say? But it kind of gets to expand further out into the world from Twilight. Twilight is so fun, but it's very contained. And I like New Moon because you get like the full scope of Bella's universe. You get the werewolves introduced properly. You get the Volturi properly introduced. You get like Victoria's unrelenting grudge against Bella. And so I like that we're getting all of our pieces together finally. And like, this feels, in my opinion, like the really big jumping off point for the Twilight Saga because we know everything now. Like, there's no more really extensive exposition, really. Like, we're just like, love story from here on out. But New Moon, we get to learn some things.
We learn a lot. We learn a lot of things in New Moon. The thing I learned the most is my capacity for how mad I can get at Edward Cullen. I get so mad at him when I rewatch this movie. I will get him. Like, I will threaten to get him for what he has done.
This man is over 100 years old and he is still a little bitch.
Yeah.
That's all I'm gonna say.
Yeah. Get him. I mean, I do have a giant life-size silk tapestry of Edward Cullen that hangs on my wall and faces my bed and watches me while I sleep. And I have been glaring at it. I'm mad.
He's the problematic fave is the problem. You know, it doesn't feel great. But I mean, I think that speaks to one of the things that I think New Moon, why New Moon is so good is because it is like such a perfect breakup movie. It is like such a relatable breakup movie. The agony that she goes through of him leaving is like really palpable. And I think as somebody who has, you know, no big deal, been broken up with before, whatever, it's fine, I'm over it. I think that it hits and it really captures like how much you like self-destroy the crap out of yourself and how much you just wallow in it. I mean, we can get to the montage. We can get to, you know, there's a possibility. But like, I mean, Claire, for you, what is that? Like, tell me about that montage and why that montage rules so hard, because it is, I mean, it captures it perfectly, the pain that she's going through.
Yeah, I think it's particularly thrilling as like someone who's also, obviously I read the books in middle school and stuff when they were coming out. Like, and in the books, the way those chapters are done, it's just a page that says like, October, November, December, and there's nothing, like, no, like, oh, Bella sat in a chair and it's October now. It's like there's just absolutely blank nothing. And so I think there's something really exciting about seeing that detail, like, visualized on screen. And I feel like they do it and capture it so effortlessly with that pan around where she's not moving and you just get the seasons passing with every window frame. And then it gradually, and I love how it ends with it fading into her sitting on the couch in, like, the same position. Like, it's just like, it's such a good little editing trick. I'm like, you're so sneaky over here in a Twilight movie giving us this. Like, I feel fed. I feel fulfilled. And, like, I feel like that is what it feels like for people, you know, when you're in that mindset of, like, my life is over. Like, there's nothing else for me in this moment. And you just, like, want to sit and, like, stew in it, basically. And I like that Bella gets to feel those feelings. I think sometimes with breakup movies, it's easy for the character to, like, kind of go a different route and be very loud and, like, crying and just sobbing all the time or yelling and just very explosive. And I think it's kind of exciting to have a film where the character just, like, is gone. Like, you're just looking at, like, a mannequin essentially just sitting there. And I like the difference in that compared to other stuff.
I was also a middle schooler coming of age when the Twilight books were big. So I feel like we were the exact demographics. Because you're also a Pacific Northwesterner, right?
Yes, 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 yes.
Okay, yes. I grew up in Portland. So I remember, like, reading that book and it felt real to me. Like, I was having intense psychic pain. Like, I felt like Edward Cullen was a real person and he had broken up with me and my life was over when I was reading that book. Like, not as many books have affected me like that. You got to give it up for Stephanie Meyer in this particular instance. I will give it up for her. And I also want to ask, speaking of Pacific Northwestern lifestyle, do you think that affected your enjoyment of the Twilight Saga? Because I feel like it bolstered mine, like, growing up in an area like that.
Totally. And I think too, like, now that I'm an adult, like, I know, like, there's a lot more movies that take place in, like, the Seattle and Pacific Northwest area. But, like, when I was younger, it felt like there were, like, none. So it was so big to, like, have something as major as Twilight be a thing, because I'd get to be like, oh, there's the Space Needle. Like, whoa, like, this is so cool. So, like, it definitely was effective in that regard. And also, like, it's just, I don't know, there's something that it nails really well with just the vibe of living in the Pacific Northwest, with the way they kind of do, like, the overcastness of the weather and, like, the water being so close and, like, all the trees kind of, like, enveloping you. Like, it feels so attuned to, like, that experience. And I really like that. It was nice having that on screen.
Yes, yes, Pacific Northwest representation. I don't want to brag, but the Cullen house is, like, a 20-minute drive from my parents' house. So that is that is the best thing about Portland, I would say. The number one best thing is that we do have the Cullen house. Portland pride.
Hell yeah.
Well, I want to talk a little bit, you know, people, when Twilight comes up, obviously there's Team Edward, there's Team Jacob, whatever, whatever, whatever. Boring to me, because I want to talk about DILFs. I want to talk about, you know, Heather.
Let's go.
On Letterboxd, Heather put this list, put this film on their list, the DILF canon. And so when I see the DILF canon, I see Twilight on there, I'm like, yeah, Charlie Swan. Absolutely. Yeah, of course, that's why it's there. Sri wrote a review saying Charlie didn't deserve any of this. I agree. You know, he's just doing his best. But then I'm looking through the Letterboxd reviews and I see this review by My V, who says, was Carlisle your first cinematic DILF, or are you normal? And I'm seeing more and more Carlisle reviews in there too. So Clara, I'm going to ask you, not Team Edward or Team Jacob, but for you, Team Charlie or Team Carlisle? Who's the DILF for you?
Ooh,
this is a devastating
question. The big questions on the Letterboxd show this week.
Wow, I'm having a crisis. God, I think I have to go Team Carlisle.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I gotta do it.
This is now a debate podcast.
Oh, no.
No. Tell me, what is it about Carlisle?
I think there's just something really nice about that dialogue exchange he gets with Bella in the beginning after she's gotten hurled into a table and has to have glass picked out of her arm. I mean, first of all, I think a lot of people point out, like, there's definitely some, like, weird tension going on in that scene. It's very charged. but not intentionally, of course. But I just, I think it, Carlisle's such an interesting character. And I think there's a slightly greater appeal to him in this movie because, like, we obviously met him in the first film, but in New Moon, we really get to know him. We get to know, like, how truly dedicated he is to not eating people and, like, his experiences kind of working with the Volturi. Like, there's so much about him that we're getting revealed in this movie, and it makes him a little more exciting. You're like, oh, you're a world traveler. You're a Renaissance man. Like, that's interesting. And, like, I love Charlie. Love Charlie so much. But Charlie's also a cop. And that always takes a little bit of points off for me.
That's a fair point. I think you're making some good points.
Yeah, yeah. I'm ready. I was actually, I fooled you. I've been ready for this the entire time.
Mia, what about you? What about you, Mia?
I have really been pondering this the entire since you brought up the question. I feel like I see Charlie more as, like, he's my dad. Charlie is my father. Whereas, like, Carlisle, Twilight gave me, like, a vampire kink, I swear. I think it genuinely did, like, reading these at a formative age. So, like, the fact that Carlisle is a vampire, hot. And he's a doctor, double hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I do have to be Team Carlisle, but I have a lot of love in my heart.
I'm getting outvoted.
Charlie.
Here.
I know. I'm sorry, Mitchell. Charlie's my father, and I love
Billy Burke. You know, Billy Burke. You and me can chat later. We'll hang out. We'll grieve. We'll grieve this moment.
I'm just trying to be a wing person to you. I'm trying to help you.
I appreciate it. Nobody's trying to get in my way of what's going to happen. What's inevitable.
Exactly.
One thing that's really dope about, I think, Twilight, because Twilight does get kind of lumped in with, like, these other YA movies, right? Like the Divergent movies, Mortal Instruments, remember that? Like all these things. But going back and, like, kind of watching the Twilight movies, and especially New Moon with what Chris Weitz is doing, I think stylistically, this movie has so many, like, dope moments that, like, I, even as somebody who's seen it multiple times, like, get caught off guard by, like, you mentioned Carlisle learning more about his history with Volturi, seeing that moment where, like, you're looking at the painting and then it goes into the painting and you see kind of the flashback. And I think my favorite moment stylistically is the montage with Bella and Jacob building the bike together, and, like, the pizza gets delivered and she throws Jacob the pizza slice and, like, the cut turns it into a wrench that he catches. Like, that, like, I lose my mind. That's cinema to me. How do you feel, Clara, about kind of the stylistic choices that are happening in New Moon?
I mean, if you're listening to the podcast, you can't see, but I'm losing my mind geeking so hard as you were just saying all that, because I'm like, yes, yes. I think that's another reason why I like this a little bit more than Twilight. I love the feel of Twilight and the aesthetics of it and, like, what it's all doing. But I think, like, editing wise, New Moon is going, like, above and beyond. Like, like you said, the pizza scene is so, like, I lose my mind every time. I'm like, look at that shot. Like,
look,
that's
at
crazy.
That shot.
I like that scene a lot. And, like, it's fun. Here's me plugging a little bit. Everyone should listen to the director's commentary of New Moon, because it's the director and the editor. So you get, like, their dialogue back and forth about the, like, the most exciting editing choices. And you're just like, whoa. And I love that scene. I think my favorite editing thing, though, in the entire movie is after Bella's jumped off the cliff and hit her head a little bit, and she's kind of in that, like, I'm drowning. She is falling back, and then the shot is wide and you get Edward gradually, like, materializing beside her. And then when Jacob grabs her arm moves out and, like, turns him into smoke. I'm like, that? I'm licking my fingers. This is so yummy. Like, I want to rewatch that scene over and over again. I love that moment. Oh my God.
I love that glimpse of Edward. I know I've been ragging on him, and I am still mad at him, but I go feral whenever she has a glimpse of Edward, because I always miss him so much when he's not on screen. So I love that scene that you're talking about. That might be my favorite scene in the movie. I also want to ask about the freaking soundtrack. I feel like the Twilight Saga New Moon soundtrack is, like, one of the best of the whole series. Like, all the alternative rock. I mean, you know, it's continuing from the first one. The first one also had a lot of alternative rock. Muse makes another appearance in this one, of course. But then, like, the Killers have a song for Twilight New Moon, a White Demon love song, which is a really awesome song title. So do you have a favorite song on the soundtrack?
Oh man, this is so hard because if people ask me, oh, which Twilight soundtrack do you like the most? It's New Moon, of course. It's New Moon. Mm-hmm. Let me see. I'm trying to like pull up my little song stats.
Oh yeah, take your time. This is very important. This is important.
This is important to me. But I have it. I'm ready. It's Satellite Heart by Anya Marina.
Oh my God, mm-hmm. Clara. Clara, yes. Clara. In high school, when my boyfriend dumped me, I listened to that song on repeat.
That is the breakup song of the century. Yes. Oh my God. Yes.
What a pity. What a sham. What's the matter with you, man?
Unfortunately, we're going to have to move off of it.
Before
we move off of it, I do have to ask one last question. So a scene that I love that is very uncomfortable, very cringy in the best of ways, is the sort of triple date with Bella Jacob. And I don't... So blonde boy at school. Mike. I don't even remember his name. Mike.
Okay. Mike's name.
So Mike, I want to talk about this because Mike... offers, he says that, you know, he asks if she wants to go see Love Spelled Backwards is Love, phenomenal movie title, but she wants to instead go see Face Punch, which is another incredible title. I know on the commentary, Chris Weitz talks about like the different names that they could have like done, and like it's all like Face Punch kind of names. I can't remember the other ones, but it's like very ones like that. And just thinking about like, I mean, those names are fantastic. I'm imagining us, the three of us, going to see Face Punch in the theater. Clara, what, after you come out of that theater, after we've seen Face Punch, what does your Letterboxd review for Face Punch look like?
Oh, I think I would say too many faces, not enough punches.
Wow, yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah. Way too many faces.
So true. My last comment on that scene, because I also love that scene, is the handhold rejection when Jacob like tries to reach for her hand and she like slithers out of it. Oh, devastating hand choreography. Oh my God.
My boy throws up too. Say that. He has to run to the bathroom.
Mike's like, no.
We gotta move on. We got three more movies to talk about here. So.
Sorry, guys.
Fine.
We're gonna move on into the Bayou. We're gonna be talking about Eve's Bayou here, 1997, directed by Cassie Lemons, her first feature as a director after being an actor for a while. The synopsis for this one: summer heats up in rural Louisiana beside Eve's Bayou in 1962 as the Batiste family tries to survive the secrets they've kept and the betrayals they've endured. This movie, this is a masterpiece. I'm going to be honest. This movie is unreal. So good. But Clara, when was, I think you vlogged this like 3 or 4 times on your Letterboxd. Yeah. What was your experience kind of the first time that you saw it? And how did it hit you that first time?
So I saw it for the first time not that long ago, actually. It was last February. And I think I even put in my initial review, like, I've seen a lot of really good movies so far this year, but like Eve's Bayou was the first watch of 2022 where like I felt like bowled over, like just like, oh my God, like it hit me so hard. And I can't, like, I still think about it like regularly, like I obviously, because I keep logging it, but like I can't get it out of my head. It's like it's really like ingrained itself in my brain, and it's just, oh, it's so captivating. It's just, I don't know. There's something so, I mean, it's dealing with the, like the concepts of magic. And I think that's so fitting because it feels like magic to me. I'm like, I get it. Like, I'm on board. It's just, man. Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. I love this movie. I'm already geeking out.
No, that's good. That's good. It's cool to geek out over movies. It is. Genuinely.
This is a podcast about geeking out about movies.
It's literally what we're here to do. So never be afraid to geek out about a movie. I am so glad that you picked this because it had been my watch list forever. I just had never watched it. And then I finally did. And I totally agree. It is a masterpiece. I regrettably watched the theatrical cut instead of the director's cut because I didn't realize there were two different versions. So I was wondering if Have you seen both versions?
I have now. And actually, my rewatch for like prepping for the podcast was my first time seeing the director's cut. So don't worry, because I also saw the theatrical cut the first two times I watched it, because I didn't realize there was a director's cut either. But then I got the Criterion Eve's Bayou disc, and it came with the director's cut. And I was like, ooh, that seems like fun. And it was really jarring, because the biggest change is really that there's like a whole nother character in the family that we don't see in the theatrical cut. And so it was like very like, whoa, like, where did you come from? But it's also kind of impressive seeing both now, because it's incredible how well they edit this character out of scenes where he's clearly in them in the director's cut. I think that's really interesting. But yeah, I've seen both now. I might be a little partial still to the theatrical cut.
But that's the one that you fell in love with first, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's the one I fell in love with. And I've seen it one more time than the director's cut now. So maybe if I rewatch the director's cut again, then we'll balance the scales a little more. But I'm leaning towards theatrical at the moment.
We kind of cover all the bases here. So Mia's only seen theatrical. Claire, you've seen both. I've only seen the director's cut. I watched the director's cut twice now. I watched it. The first time I saw it was when the Criterion came out. And I just went straight to the director's cut. And then rewatching it for the podcast, I realized this morning that I probably should have watched the theatrical to compare. But I just love the director's cut so much.
Yeah.
That like I just wanted to go back to it. I wanted to mention, so this, it's like one of those films that I had always kind of heard of, but hadn't watched until the Criterion came out. And I think one of the big reasons why it has like the legacy that it got is because Roger Ebert named it as the best film of 1997 when it came out. And he was like a huge champion for it. And I was reading like his review for it. And he compared it a lot to Ingmar Bergman's autobiographical films, specifically referencing The Sense of Magic in Fanny and Alexander, and how that film captures like youthful innocence, especially while trying to understand like that feeling of being a kid and not like observing the adults around you and like thinking that you understand what's going on, but not fully understanding, and like kind of that age where you start to learn more and more, and how the world becomes like more terrifying, more confusing, the more you learn about the world. And I wanted to ask you, Clara, like how you feel as far as like Eve's Bayou as sort of like a coming of age movie, as a movie capturing like the innocence of youth and that warp of innocence, how effective you find Eve's Bayou in capturing that kind of age that we see Eve's at?
Oh, super well. And I think that's one of the things that keeps it so cemented in like my top four, because I have a few that rotate in and out, but like Eve's Bayou has like stayed there for a long time now. And I think it's in part because we spend so much of the film like specifically with Eve. And so you really become ingrained in her perspective and the way she's kind of processing the things she's learning as she goes along. But then you also get these scenes that kind of cut away from her entirely, where you're seeing her mom and her aunt interacting, or like the adults arguing in the other room. And like you get these perspectives that kind of remove the kids entirely. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that balance is really what helps it shine in illustrating like the kid's perspective, because as an audience member, then you're getting both like the innocent perspective of a child versus like the more wise, we'll put that in quotes, perspective of an adult. And I think the blending of the two works out really well, and just like how Lemons decides to like go from one to the other, and like where we're getting those moments. Like it's just, it's really special. Like it's hard for me to think of other films that balance the two quite as well as it does here in Eve's Bayou.
Yeah, she really captures like the idea of being a kid. Everything is so impressionistic. Like you see and feel these things, but you can't really analyze them. And I think that the lyrical editing is so great at evoking that feeling of like having a sudden sense memory, like the black and white high contrast memory sequences of like spiders and things. It reminded me of Maya Deren's Meshes of the Afternoon. Like it reminded me of that, but then it also reminded me of more modern films like After Sun and Past Lives, like the way that memories are stitched into those films as well. So you can see like how it has influenced modern movies. And I think that is incredible. We love to see that. And then also the whole idea of memories, it's such an interesting subject, like the subjectivity of them. And I think honestly, like one of life's greatest challenges and horrors is like, who can you trust if you can't trust your own mind and memories, you know, and like nobody else can see them except for Eve has her little power. So
yeah, that's so spot on. And it makes me think of that. It's hard not. I think a lot of people would say this is like one of the best shots in the entire movie, but it's that shot that the camera's facing a mirror and yeah. even her aunt are standing and then she's recounting a story and you see them in the background and then she gradually transfers from being like outside the mirror to being in the memory. And like, I think the way they illustrate that is so like striking and thrilling, because it's just like, how did we get here? Like, we were outside and now we're inside the memory with our characters all of a sudden. And it's so neat how we're getting ingrained in the story with them.
Yeah, the blurring of kind of like the present with the past and how like we are all, you know, only figments of like what our past has led us to, I think is really effectively drawn out here. And I think one thing too, with this being Cassie Lemon's, you know, her coming from acting, being in movies like Vampire's Kiss, Silence of the Lambs, Candyman, like doing these great performances, and this being her first feature as a director, it makes sense that the performances across the board in this are absolutely incredible. From Journey Smollett as Eve, like so young, so good. Megan Good, also fantastic. Debbie Morgan, I think, is incredible. Samuel L. Jackson in like a really unnerving and complicated, yeah. like he's so charming, but also really like intimidating. You're afraid of him in one scene, but kind of comforted by him in the next. Like, it's such a complicated performance. And I wanted to ask you, Claire, do you have like an MVP of the cast for you? Like a performance here that's your favorite?
Oh gosh, what a question.
Should I ask you what your new moon, what your favorite new moon song is again? Is that an easier one?
Let's go back to New Moon. I think it has to be Journeys. Like, I think her yeah. role as Eve is so magnetic. Like, and you feel what she's feeling so tangibly. And people talk about this all the time. That can be really tricky for like a child actor to nail. And I feel like she's nailing it. Obviously not effortlessly. I'm sure there was a lot of work that went into that, but it feels almost effortless as you're watching it, because it feels like she's really like grounded in what she's doing on screen. And so it's just like, it blows me away every yeah. time.
She's so good.
And then Mitchell, I'm glad you brought up how complicated Samuel L. Jackson's performance is, because I feel like that his relationship with Cicely, the older daughter, is like, it's one of the most like brutally honest and also incredibly complicated, but also ultimately incredibly simple. I think then there's like a lot of discussion about the ending. I'm definitely, don't worry everyone, I'm not going to spoil anything.
No,
we will not be doing that. But like the quote unquote ambiguity of the ending is such an interesting litmus yes. test, because in some ways it's both, as I said, it's both complicated and simple. And I think it would be really, really hard to explore that idea, especially on film, like with children. So I just want to give a shout out to Lemons for being able to handle that really tricky territory. What do you think of the ending? Not necessarily what you think happened, but I mean, like, how did that affect you? Because it really affected me.
Yeah, it hit really hard. And I think that was partially because, like, I always had a very complicated but not complicated relationship with my own dad, and so it was very jarring to kind of see this illustrated on screen in such a clear-cut way. And you really kind of have to sit in like the question of like, okay, who am I really gonna like believe in this moment? And I like the challenge of that, of like, okay, like where are we landing, where are we really leaning into things? And that's a big part of why I like the film too. I love a film where the ending's a little ambiguous and it kind of leaves room for you to have to draw your own conclusions to have any kind of like comfort in the end. And I think that's just, it's challenging and definitely not for everyone, but it's a selling point for me for sure, of like having to sit in the movie and be like, what am I thinking? What am I feeling now? Like, what's going on?
Oh yeah, I took a big long walk after finishing Eve's body.
I love endings yeah. that make you need to take a walk. I also love, I mean, the opening too is so good. Brian Sweeney's Letterboxd review, I really love. Brian's review says, "Tired, American Beauty starting a movie with, in less than a year I'll be dead. Wired, Eve's Bayou starting a movie with, the summer I killed my father, I was 10 years old."
Yes.
When you first saw it, like, I mean, that being like an opening line in a movie, like how much does that like draw you in? Because it really makes you like feel like, oh, this, I want to know, what, you know, how the fuck she killed her dad? Why she killed her dad? Like, what's going on with this?
Yeah, it's really jarring. And I think from my perspective, I was immediately like, oh, like this is going to be a complicated story. Because I think a lot of the time with kids, when like even just if your parents get divorced or if like you lose a parent, there is that need almost to kind of put the blame somewhere because it makes it easier to understand. And I think as kids, it's easy to almost like latch on to that guilt yourself and be like, this is me. And so I was really like, oh, this is about to be so complicated because it could be very literal, but it could also be very abstract. It could be very like just her perspective of things. Like there's so many directions it can go. And especially the fact that like we're hearing an adult Eve give that line, like that makes it even more grounding because it immediately makes us know that this is like very reflective. So I was like, this line, I'm sold. I love a good opening line and I'm ready to go.
I wanted to mention, Clara, in one of your reviews, so I saw this list by Vanina on Letterboxd. The list is called Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, First Periods on Film. And Clara, in one of your reviews, you mention it being very refreshing to see menstruation, you know, depicted, talked about in this movie because it's not something that we get to see that often. And it made me think about the movie Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, that came out this year, which is such a good movie. And thinking about the fact that that movie got rated PG-13 for the MPAA's like rating for it, the reason was sexual education. And it's like, how the fuck is a movie that is just talking about menstruation getting a PG-13? Like, that is like the most PG movie I've ever seen. So, Clara, I wanted to ask you about like just elaborating on that a bit, kind of what it feels like the refreshingness of seeing a movie just openly talking about menstruation, because it does feel shockingly, disturbingly rare to just have that be a conversation in a film.
Yeah. And it's always like, it's interesting experiencing those rare moments where it's brought up in film, because it's almost like when you get a scene on screen where someone gets like slapped unexpectedly and you're like, that's how I feel almost when people bring up menstruation on screen. I'm like, they said the word. Like, it's just like, oh my God. And it's just, it's hard growing up in an environment like that. Like, honestly, like I remember getting my first period and being like, I'm dying. Like something's really wrong with me. And I do think like, obviously part of that is like, I did sex ed in fifth grade, but maybe that didn't prepare me enough. But I think the other part of it is that we don't get that a lot in film. And like, I was definitely a little bit heated when I saw the rating for Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
Cause
it's
crazy.
Like, what in the, I'm like, dude, are you being so serious? Like, let's be for real right now. This is like a childhood, like American classic. I don't think it's PG-13. Like, let's be a little more serious here. It's a really, really exciting thing to see it come up more and more. I think we're getting a lot. I mean, Turning Red is a big one more recently. And then with Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret as well. Like, I think it's really comforting from like a backseat perspective to know that like younger kids are getting more movies like this. It's just what barriers are being put in place to prevent them from seeing it now. Cause like, they're there more often, but now we're getting stricter ratings, which is just like, you're being so silly. It's exciting. I'm looking forward to those lists of like, these are the movies that talk about periods. I'm always eager to see those expand. I think every movie we should just have someone get their period. Let's just do it.
Yes. No, I also support this. I mean, like when I was 12 or 13 and I got my first period, I remember thinking like, why don't movie characters talk about this ever? Like, why am I not seeing this or like reading about this? Because it's something that many, many, many people go through. And it's like, when you really think about it, it is insane that this is just something, you know, like in elementary school, I had like a friend and she had an older sister and she was like, my older sister said that like, when you get older, like you bleed from your vagina. And I was like, no, I don't even know. That's like a horror story that she made up to scare you. Yeah. That cannot be real. And I don't believe you.
Yeah. I think Are You There, God? It's Me. I mean, as somebody who, you know, doesn't menstruate, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, I think does such a good job of like educating me on like what that experience is as like a young person who is going to menstruate, like growing up, and the sort of like this like ritual of like who's getting it first, who's not, and like the kind of status that comes with that and everything, and like the jealousy and the shame with like not getting it mixed with the fear of like when you do get it. Like, I think that movie captures that like so well. It is such like a great educational tool for anybody, people who are going to experience that, to understand, like normalize it in a way, and then people who don't to also normalize it in a way, you know? So it's like a thing that like we should just be talking about openly. Like it's not, it doesn't have to be a big, like it's a big deal obviously, but like it doesn't have to be like a big deal where we're like afraid to fucking talk about it.
Yeah. Snaps to that.
No, after I saw Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, I chatted with my group of like a bunch of different genders, and we all talked about periods outside the movie theater, and like they were asking questions, and it was really, really lovely. So that's our period spiel. Thank you, everyone.
Period talk over.
Love talking about my period. Yeah.
Wow, from periods to Miyazaki. How about that?
Yeah.
Hiya, Miyazaki. He talks about period. We know it. We know you do.
Yeah,
we
know
you
do, Miyazaki. That that's what every Studio Ghibli film is about. Howl's Moving Castle, 2004, 4.3 average, 43,000 members have it in their four faves. Is this true? That's a lot of people.
Number 122 on the Letterboxd Top 250 of all time.
Wow.
Big love.
And yet, Wallace and Gromit, Curse of the Were-Rabbit, beat it out for best animated feature at the Oscars. Mm-mm. That's so wacky. Well, let's say what it's about. When Sophie, a shy young woman, is cursed with an old body by a spiteful witch, her only chance of breaking the spell lies with a self-indulgent yet insecure young wizard and his companions in his legged walking castle. Yup, just another everyday tale. This is always happening to me.
All the time. This happened to my friend Greg. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Mitchell, give us a fact, okay?
Okay.
Can you give us a fact?
Here's a fun fact. It's Miyazaki's second most popular film on Letterboxd after Spirited Away, his third highest rated after that and Princess Mononoke. One thing that I was excited to learn in doing kind of research about it is that Miyazaki this is based on a novel, but he was influenced to make the movie by his kind of opposition to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Mm. And that's what propelled a lot of like the anti-war themes in it, which I think I read that before I started watching it, and watching it, you can really like feel that, especially like, I think there are so many movies from around that time period where maybe watching them at the time as like, I was like 12 when like 9/11 happened. And so like, I wasn't really having like contextualization of movies coming out like right after that, of like knowing like, oh, this is what subtle themes are. This is what subtext is, right? And so like going back and watching a movie like this and placing it as coming, you know, a couple years after 9/11, as, you know, this invasion is still happening and everything, it really like points how hard he is criticizing these moves. And I think it speaks to how beautiful Howl's Moving Castle is in just embracing love and like being kind to each other and like finding sort of these bonds and connection. Claire, what is it for you that makes Howl's Moving Castle one of your favorite movies?
Oh man. It's definitely one that I find myself growing more and more attached to the older I get. Cause like, I honestly don't remember a time in my life like before knowing Miyazaki films. Like my sisters and I were big like Spirited Away fans and Castle in the Sky, and then also Howl's Moving Castle were like our three really big ones. And then obviously as I got older, I was watching more of his stuff. But Howl's specifically, I think, is just such an interesting way, like you said, Mitchell, to talk about love. And I think it's such a neat depiction of that in the film, because so much of those displays of love are very like physical, practical things. Like Howl doesn't have a heart in his chest, but Calcifer, the personification of his heart, is like what shelters the people Howl loves. Mm. And I think that's so cute. Like they're kept warm and they're kept safe and they're kept like secure because of Howl's heart in a way. And that feels really neat to see on screen. And I also really like just the way this film kind of deals with the notion of aging, and how at first it's this horrific thing that's happened to Sophie, but in her aging, she's also found community that she didn't have when she was this young, like youthful person. Mm. And so it's a neat like turning of that expectation of like, oh, when you get older, like, oh, your life's over, like everything's gonna suck. But in this film, we get the opposite of that, which is that Sophie gets to go on like the biggest adventure of her life and find the love of her life and like really grow as a person because of her aging. And I think that's really neat to see on screen in any capacity, but honestly, especially in like an animated film.
Especially in an animated film, and especially, yeah, with a woman, because there is,
yes,
ageism affects women in a different way, yes. I will say, without going too hard.
What are you talking about?
What? What? You would have thunk it. Yeah, it's like once you straight up, like once you turn even just like 30 as a woman, it's like, oh, you're so dried up and shriveled now. And it's like, that's not true. We're getting wiser. We're like getting smarter. I'm pro-aging women. So this is, thank you, Howl's Moving Castle, for that.
Yes.
This movie's also so gender.
Yes, so gender.
It's
gender
so everywhere. Gender is everywhere. Howl, I love Howl's little earrings. Like, Howl is kind of, I mean, Howl is non-binary to me. I don't know you all feel. Just checking in.
This movie's on Charlie's Letterboxd list, whatever the trans guy version of Chick Flicks is. And I think that's perfect because, watching it, I mean, as like a trans person watching it, I'm like, this movie's like super trans. Like, it's all about like being like in this body, like kind of figuring out like being like the person that you are and like transformations of bodies and like finding yourself more complete in a body different than the one you were born with. And I'm like, oh shit, Miyazaki, I think you're onto something here, buddy. What's going on?
Yep. Yeah, yep. That's real. I don't have anything to add to that. I'm just like, retweet. I feel it.
Let me ask you, Claire, I know, so Holly's review on Letterboxd says, I'm normally anti-dubbing, but Christian Bale's Howl voice makes several points. I chose to watch the English dub version mostly because I wanted to hear Billy Crystal as a little fire dude, which was a hoot. I know Mia also watched the dub. Clara, what about you? Are you anti-dub? Do you like both? Do you think that both can exist and be welcomed? Or are you like, if you're watching the dub, you're a fool and I need to get off this podcast?
No. I think there's validity in a dub and a sub. And I would say for the most part, I try and lean towards sub, but I grew up with Miyazaki as a kid and I grew up with the dubbed versions because my parents didn't know that there was a difference, if we're being honest. And so like, I do find with Miyazaki specifically, it is kind of hard for me almost to be like, I'll watch the sub today. I'm a little bit like, no, like I have to hear Christian Bale say, that's my girl. Like I need that. That's part of the experience. So I definitely also watch the dub.
Studio Ghibli, their voice casts are really stacked.
Exquisite.
They are exquisite. I mean, this one, you know, I love Emily Mortimer. I think she's such an underrated actress. So you have Emily Mortimer, as we said, Christian Bale and Billy Crystal. Then you also have Jenna Malone, little baby Jenna Malone, little baby Josh Hutcherson, and then legends like Lauren Bacall and Gene Simmons. Bacall. Yeah. So I am also, we will be supporting the English dub of Howl's Castle.
We gotta.
Ultimately, we do have to.
One thing that I don't support, I have a gripe with Miyazaki here. So there's a scene where when Howl comes out screaming that Sophie has ruined his hair, like it's the worst thing that's ever happened. He's completely suicidal. He's beside himself. He's being a little baby about it. And then we see his hair and it's just red. It's just red. And so my question is, watching this, is this movie anti-redhead? Is that what I'm getting out of this?
It might be. I hate to say this to you. I hate to confirm this for you. I'd love to be like, no, of course not. But I think it might be. Right?
Howl's Moving Castle, anti-redhead.
Yeah.
Our next honeymoon, pro-redhead?
Pro-redhead. Yes. Bro, right.
2014, directed by Lee Janiak, 3.1 average. So kind of a low on the lower side compared to some of these other movies that we're talking about, Howl's and East Bayou. The synopsis for Honeymoon, young newlyweds Paul and Bea travel to a remote lake cottage for their honeymoon where the promise of private romance awaits them. Shortly after arriving, Paul finds Bea wandering and disoriented in the middle of the night. What's going on with Bea? Clara, so this one, I was really excited. One of the things that I really love about this podcast is like talking about people's four favorite movies of all time. A lot of them, you know, sometimes are like ones that we know and love. You know, all due respect to Emilio Estevez, but he came on the podcast, four movies that were all in the Letterboxd Top 100 of all time, like that we've seen a ton of times. The thing that I love is when somebody comes on with a movie like Honeymoon, and it's like one that neither me or I had seen. I had heard of it, but I hadn't seen it. It's definitely like on the lower side compared to these other three, like not as many people have watched it. And so like the idea of you loving it so much and like wanting to introduce it to more people is really exciting for me. So why don't you tell us a little bit about why Honeymoon like hits so hard for you?
Yeah, it's a film that I watched like totally blindly. Like I think I watched it in 2016. It was like a new addition to Netflix or something. And at the time when I was in college, and I had this habit of just going to Netflix, going to horror specifically, and then just kind of watching almost in like alphabetical order. I was like, I'm just gonna watch everything. Why not? Like, let's just do it. And Honeymoon got thrown on, and I kind of put it on and I was like, I'm a little bit sleepy. I'll probably fall asleep. It's fine, whatever. And it woke me up so fast. I was like, what is going on in this little cabin in the woods? and it's just, I don't know. It's one that's really stuck to me. I have a really strong like affinity for people's like horror debuts and like just I'm trying to think of the right word for it. The boldness of them sometimes. Like I think of like Brandon Cronenberg's Antiviral. I love that movie too. I almost actually picked that, but I was like, no, I'll do Honeymoon. love Honeymoon. I love Censor from a few years ago. Like that's such an exciting film. Oh my God, Censor. So But there's just something about like horror debuts that feel especially like I'm just gonna fucking go for it. And I think that works out really well with something like Honeymoon, where it feels kind of reminiscent to me as like The Strangers, which I'm also like a really big fan of The Strangers, of just this happy couple in the woods and they're in love. And then all of a sudden things go totally wrong. And I think I like Honeymoon because for a very large chunk of the film, you don't know exactly what's actually gone wrong. And I like the tension of like, what the fuck is happening? Like, is this all in someone's head? Like, is it this other person? Is it something entirely different? Like, there's so much questioning going on. And I find that especially exciting because I like a movie that makes me like feel like I have to just constantly be trying to keep up, because it's like, I need to know what's going on. And so it's always really sold me on that, the mystery of it. And like, honestly, the final sequence especially is what always really sticks in my head. Just like, I get full body goosebumps every time, because like, you're like, oh, this is happening. Like, this is really happening. And then you're almost a little bit like, maybe it won't happen. And then it does. And you're just like, fuck. Like, I love a final ending like that, where you're just left reeling like, oh, wow. Like, we went there today. And you it's exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, so from the Letterboxd backdrop, I thought that this was going to be like a micro-budget mumblecore chill romance, which, and I like movies like that, so I was already excited to watch it, yeah. And then, like, we had like, some meeting, and Mitchell was like, did you watch Honeymoon yet? It was effed up. And I was like, wait, what are you talking about?
I was reeling. I was trying to recover from the night before.
Yeah, I was like, what? And then I realized it was like a body horror type movie, which is so up my alley. And I was like, wait, body horror and romance? So I was so excited to watch this one. So thank you again for picking this one. I love a body horror as a metaphor for something else.
Yes, me too.
In this case, like, this was another movie that I had to take a big walk about. I took a midnight walk last night and thought about the movie Honeymoon. Yeah, it was life altering. But when I was walking around and thinking about this effed up movie, I think the metaphor, like, there are so many interpretations I think that you can have of it, which is very, very powerful. And what I had been kind of settling on was like, it's about the literal alienation from one's own body and like from one's own life and one's own relationship. And so I think that this one maybe is the one that, like, I keep coming back to out of the four faves, that it keeps like popping up and I keep thinking about it. Like, you know, I finished it and I was like, oh, that was good. But like, the more I think about it, the more I'm like, oh, there are so many interesting little themes. And like, because it's a little bit confusing when you're watching it purposefully, which is like not a critique at all. And then I love a movie that's like a puzzle, where the more you think about it, the more you unlock what it's going for.
Yeah.
it's on this list on Letterboxd from Blake called Mumble Gore, which I think is like, ooh, first of all, what a great title for a list. And also I think perfectly captures it, because it does start as like this very just, you know, mumblecore-y kind of movie, this couple in the woods, etc. And then like you both are talking about, like, you really feel like you're kind of trying to figure it out as it's going on, which is exciting because that's exactly what Paul is doing too. Like, he's trying to figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I loved Charlie Nash wrote a review that of Honeymoon that says, "Its examination of a couple being destroyed by something truly terrifying works both as a straight-faced horror film and as a chilling allegory to the anxiety-ridden form of isolation someone may feel during a relationship that's going nightmarishly downhill." Mm-hmm. And I think that really perfectly captured what I was experiencing watching it. The thing that I kept coming back to in terms of like allegory is this idea of like sexual pressure in relationships. Mm-hmm. Like watching it, I kept feeling like even in the honeymoon phase kind of scenes early on, I'm like, this dude like is constantly talking about sex and just like always wanting it. Yeah. And it's like, that's a lot of pressure to put on somebody. And then you see her start kind of distancing. And me and Mia both, in both of our notes, we cited the scene where he comes home and B is in the mirror, just like, like rehearsing reasons why, like excuses why she's not going to want to have sex with him later. And I think, Mia, you said it really well in your notes, like, if I see my partner in the bathroom mirror, like practicing like reasons why they don't want to have sex with me, like I am rethinking every single decision I've made in my entire life.
Yeah. Yes.
No, yeah, it would rock my world. I would be like you can't see, but my mouth is open, like jaw dropped. Yes. It would really, really alter my entire perception of who I am.
Maybe I'm an enormous piece of shit.
Yeah, it's like, am I the bad guy? the other scene we both cited is when he like catches that giant frog and then like pretends to eat it. And he's like joking. He's like, ho, ho, ho. And then he looks at his wife and is like, why aren't you laughing?
Yeah. And I was like, B, I get it, because I love frogs. And that always bought. I'm like, okay, Paul, I was trying to side with you and be like, oh, yeah, this is scary for you, too. And now I'm like, no.
No.
When I was watching it, like when that scene happened, I wrote down in my notes, like, this is the frog scene is the nastiest scene. And then, but then later on, that was
later scene.
There's stuff going inside of and outside of body parts where, like, I literally in my notes just wrote gross, 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 gross.
Yes.
Like, I was in the bedroom watching this on like my laptop, just like actually screaming, like, no, 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 don't do that. Don't do that. Why is this happening?
Yep.
Very effective.
Another example of whole horror.
Whole horror.
I famously love to talk about whole horror on our podcasts. It's something that Cronenberg, you know, usually we mostly just get it in Cronenberg movies, but this one I was like, oh, this is Cronenbergian. Thank God. another entry into whole horror. Do you like whole horror, Clara? Do you need to know what that is? Do you know what that is, or is it self-explanatory?
I think I'm getting the vision like almost immediately. I don't think I've ever thought about it in that regard, but I love it. I love a hyper niche. I love ultra niche. So I think you've just sold me and I'm ready. Where's the letterbox list? I'm going to go through it all.
And whole horror. Mia, why haven't you made a whole horror list?
I am on it right after this. First, I'm going to bump New Moon up to 5 stars and then I'm going to make a whole horror list.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah, that is Clara's impact.
Mia, while you're making your whole horror list, before we wrap up, I wanted to dive, you know, to kind of close this out, dive a little bit into some of Clara's stats on Letterboxd. Oh, and I wanted to mention, so in your rate, something that I like, this is a bonding moment for you and me, something in your rated lower than average section in your stats, which are the films that you've rated lower than like the average rating on Letterboxd, is Avengers Endgame. You've given a 1-star rating, which I really respect because I don't like that movie. But it brings me to something that I've been enjoying on your House of Cinema podcast with Joe Aragon. You guys, mostly on your Patreon, you've been going through the MCU films and doing episodes for each one. And listening to that, I grew an appreciation for the fact that Joe is an incredible Hulk defender, which I also am. I maintain that is the best film in the entire MCU, which people listening, I can't be canceled. So nobody can cancel me for that opinion. But Clara, I wanted to ask you, so that's my extremely hot MCU take, is that Incredible Hulk is the best one. For you, going through and kind of rewatching them and everything for the pod, what is your hottest MCU take?
My hottest take at this point, because like there's plenty
early
to
days,
go through.
Yeah.
Early days in a way. I mean, we've done a lot, but there's also still so many.
There's a lot of these movies.
They've really cashed in on the superhero stuff. I think my hottest take at this point is that people only don't like Ant-Man more because he keeps getting put after Avengers movies, and that's fair to him. Ant-Man is my boy. He's my son. I love him, and I'm a very firm Ant-Man is the best person. And I do think a lot of the time what happens is you get like Age of Ultron, and then you go from something like so like kind of intense, and then you get Ant-Man who he is having a good time with the bugs.
He's just a little guy
and he's just hanging out with ants, and then everyone's like, this is not as cool. And I'm like, no, you are wrong. It's just Ant-Man. I love Ant-Man. Although I will also say, and I talked about this extensively on our Patreon, is that Ant-Man gets ants not... They do ants wrong in these movies. They're not scientifically accurate. And
ant facts
had
very incorrect in the films.
Yeah, I had a whole little ant fact corner to be like, hey, I love this movie, but we need to talk about this. But yeah, I'm just a stark Ant-Man guy. Like, I just want to defend Ant-Man for the rest of my life. And I do feel like that's kind of a hot take at this point.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that they like program it as like the palate cleanser, but it like kind of gets people to like not respect the Ant-Man movies as much. Mia, hottest MCU take? Out of the three or four that you've watched?
Well, exactly. And three out of those four were all the Ant-Men. They were all Ant-Men. Yes, exactly. I was doing the Ant-Man press junket for the newest one, so I had to an Ant-Man crash course and watch all of the Ant-Men. And I went into it like, I don't want to. But then I was like, wait, Ant-Man's kind of a funny little guy. So I had a really fun time.
He's just working at Baskin Robbins, having a good time.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, Peyton Reed made Down with Love, which is one of my four faves also.
Mm.
So you got to respect that. But I'm going to agree with you. I admittedly have not really seen many MCU movies because they're not my cup of tea. But I, out of all of them, I think Ant-Man, the first one, is my favorite one I've seen.
Yes.
So I'm on your team, on your ant team.
Hell yeah. Thank you for being here.
So in your rated higher than average, which is one of my favorite sections in the stats, Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium, 5 stars. talk to me about it. Talk to me about the Wonder Emporium.
Oh my God, I'm such a sucker for a nostalgia watch. And I love that movie. I loved that movie as a child. I was like obsessed with that movie when it came out. And I was definitely like slightly aged above the age demographic for that. I was not the target audience for Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium. But I don't know. I think I just like it because it's got such like a quirky little charm to it. And it's also kind of very like in your face about death and dying. And I like a movie about death and dying in that regard. And I think it tackles the concept of it very empathetically. And it's also probably one of the earliest movies I remember watching where someone knows they're dying and it's not like this terrifying thing for them. Like they're very at peace and like kind of almost ready for it. And I found that really comforting as like a kid who was like riddled with anxiety about dying when I was little. I was so scared of the concept of that. And then I watched that movie and I was like, oh, we're fine. And it was really nice. Yeah, everything's going to be okay now. And so I just have such a special place in my heart for that wacky little movie. It's so silly. I love that movie.
We've got Timothée Chalamet playing young Wonka origin story, whatever. Yeah, I'm over it.
Yeah.
But
okay.
The Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium prequel origin story. Who are you casting to play young Mr. Megorium?
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. Okay.
I'm asking the big questions.
This is so interesting. I think I want to say, this is like such a rando, but I think I kind of want Lucas Gage to do it. Lucas Gage, give me that. Yes. I would like that. Yeah.
That's,
I think,
fantastic. That'd be fun. Mia?
Lucas Gage, yeah. Skylar Gisondo.
Of course. Okay.
Hey, right? Right?
All right.
Okay.
There you go. That's both. Okay. Put them
and
both
now
in
we've
there.
Cast it.
Now we've cast it.
We've cast it.
Well, who would you cast, Mitchell?
Yeah, you didn't answer the question.
Yeah,
come
hello.
On. Who is your young Mr. Megorium?
I'm asking questions I don't even have the answer to. All right. Well, that's interesting. Jennifer Coolidge? Could Jennifer Coolidge play?
For a young Mr.
Megorium?
Sure.
Why not?
Yeah.
Right?
It's magic. Yeah, why not?
It's magic.
It's magic.
Exactly.
You're right. It is magic.
Yeah.
So we got Jennifer Coolidge, Lucas Gage, and Skylar Gisondo. It can be like that. What was that movie that is
perfect?
I get it confused, Mr.
Imaginarium
Megorium.
Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus?
Yes, we
That's
can do,
exactly what I was about to say.
Exactly. Yes, we can do an Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Perfect.
Our guest today was Claire Curtis, and you can find them on Letterboxd, Twitter, Instagram, all the places at the links in our show notes, and follow their podcast, House of Cinema, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thanks to our crew, editorial producer Brian Formo, our booker, Sophie Shin, Sam for the art, Moniker for the theme music, and Slim for all the fancy edits. Please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts as it helps us keep this show going. And you can always drop us a line at podcast@letterboxd.com because we love mail. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production. This is a Tape Deck podcast.